When you were in Baghdad and I was in Fallujah, you were expertly leading night after night after night. And what were you doing? You were saying, what's the vision? Where the vision is the where, the strategy is the how. How do you find the how that de-risks the solution as best as possible? I was the kid who could get the second marshmallows. I had 22-year-old kids out of Harvard, Princeton, Yale saying, nobody cares that you just ran a whole SEAL team, you know? You have to design a system where individuals can fail, but the organization can't. It's only failure if you fail and didn't learn. If you want to hear it, great, that's how you get better, because what I'm saying is either true or false. But when you're actually in the moment of hearing it, it's harder. That was a very risky decision, because that general literally could say, thanks for playing, you're not following orders, you're going home.
Warning, ladies and gentlemen, warning. This is an explicit episode. There may be swear words and or adult themes to follow. So if you have kids in the car, we'd love you to listen to another episode. Thank you. Welcome one. Welcome all. Welcome back to The Warrior Poet. I am so excited for today's episode. First, a quick note. You may have noticed some smaller episodes where I drop thoughts more frequently, kind of like a daily podcast, like a plog, if we could call it that. I actually noticed, coincidentally, that Naval Ravikant, who at least one person, I'm not going to say some people compare me to him, but at least one friend compared this podcast to his. So that's way more praise than I probably deserve. But I noticed Naval started dropping 2-3 minute episodes the other day. The series that I'm calling it is 4 minutes underwater. And even though I didn't copy Naval's short episodes, I definitely took inspiration for 4 Minutes Underwater from him and his saying that most books can be distilled down to a single blog post. So I took that to heart and wanted to get you little thoughts, little pieces of what I think are wisdom anyway, and distill them down, get them to you more frequently. So hope you like that format. If you do, would love to hear from you, would love for you to leave a review or reach out to me on Instagram at Shree the Warrior Poet. Today's episode is one that I've been thinking about way before I even started the podcast. I knew I wanted to interview Mike Hayes. Mike Hayes was the EXO executive officer at SEAL Team 10 when I was there. He eventually became the commanding officer of SEAL Team 2. Multiple combat deployments, a very storied career, was held up at gunpoint, threatened with execution, was a White House fellow, which, my friends, is not easy to get into, as you might imagine. In that position, he actually played a key role in renegotiating a nuclear treaty. Can you imagine that? He's not a random guy, but a military officer with no experience in nuclear treaties, international negotiations necessarily, and he gets thrust in this position and ends up bringing key leaders at the executive level of the United States government to compromise and to effectively negotiate outcomes for that treaty. That's amazing, right? Amazing. And that's just one of the many accomplishments. Mike has one of the many stories that he relates in his book, Never Enough. I can't recommend it highly enough. You should definitely go and get a copy from your local library or buy it on Amazon or wherever books are sold. Mike is a good friend, a mentor, and I learned a lot from him even in this podcast. And it was a while since we had talked, and it was just so great to get in touch with him again. And by the way, he's not just a great leader, he's a great human being. All of the profits from his book are being donated to charities that support military families who have lost their loved one in the line of duty. I sincerely hope you enjoy this episode and, more than that, take away as much as I did. And off we go. I am extremely delighted to bring to the Warrior Poet Podcast someone I've had in mind to bring on from the very beginning, from inception. And that is Mike Hayes, SEAL officer, acclaimed author now, and digital leader, alum of Bridgewater, currently chief digital transformation officer at VMware. Mike, I'm so glad to have you here.
Hey, Andrew, it's my pleasure. It's, you know, just such an honor to be able to be with you. You know, I think the world of you. I've got a couple of things to surprise the audience with and say, but let me not tip my entire hand in the opening here. But any time with you is the best time on the planet.
Awesome, man. Likewise. So one thing that I was thinking about in preparation for our chat today, and it's been a little while, is that I don't remember you having any nicknames. So listeners of The Warrior Poet will know that I've kind of undergone a rebrand of Shree. My given name is Andrew. Spoony, Spoon Man, Spoon was a nickname in the SEAL teams. I've got many others throughout my life. I don't recall you having a nickname. So you must have some.
Yeah, any pejorative thing you can think of is my nickname. But you know, the benefit of having a four-letter first name is it's easy to roll off the tongue. But I've done more wrong in my life than I've done right. So I can answer to any of that for you.
Awesome. Awesome. I wanted to start by talking about your origin story. That's generally how I start with folks in the podcast. And we've had some SEALs on recently who, you know, at least the episodes that have been released, Nat Thompson, Will Branham, but everyone's origin story is different. We all get to the teams or anything we do through different paths, even though from the outside, it might appear that we're all this monolith, largely white, male, athletic, generally very, very smart and articulate, extroverted, but we all have our own unique characteristics as we know, and that's what make that experience super rich. One thing that stood out to me in the book, which I already knew about you, was your Catholic background. I also, even though I don't look it, am a little bit Irish Catholic. A lot on the Catholic, a little bit Irish. Tell us about how that shaped who you are.
Yeah, wonderful. I love the question. But let me start by not passing over the premise of your windup there. I'm definitely some of those things you said, but not all. So, but, you know, as far as, look, I think really you can take Catholicism, you can take any world religion, you can take any kind of values framework and really distill it to the core of what it is. And to me, the Catholic faith, like so many different faiths around, you know, the five world major world religions, have an element of others before self, about thinking about the what you give more than what you take, and the way that you carry yourself on the planet, the way that you lean into problems, the way you recognize you do things wrong and ask for forgiveness, and recognize that we are all imperfect and we all are striving to be more perfect, and none of us will ever get there, but it's that journey that that is really the main effort, the main path there. And so I come from a long line of Irish Catholic ancestors. My grandfather was really my hero. I wrote about him, as you know, in the book. He was U.S. Naval Academy class of 40, and then December 7th, 1941, found himself at Pearl Harbor on that day of infamy. There's too much to even talk about him right now. But what I'll tell you is, to answer your question, to connect to your question, is that he really instilled in me a sense of duty and values, as my parents did as well. And so ultimately, I think that value framework, while I was, you know, 10 or 16 or in college, 18 to 21, whatever. Like, I didn't really recognize it as much then, but as I just turned 50 a week and a half ago. So I'm on my, what I like to call my second third of life right now. but anyways, there's just so much to do and so many things to go tackle, but lots of fun. But the main thing there, Shree, is really thinking about how we make this place better in the ways that are important, unique to us, that we're able to do.
That's awesome. And I know you mentioned your grandmother's two sisters were nuns in the Catholic Church. And this isn't by any means a religious podcast, but I just can relate a lot to what that means and what that life is like, and that sense of duty and obligation. How do you think that maybe Catholicism, your grandfather, and I'll throw out New England as well, because there's way more New Englanders represented in the teams than I ever would have liked, especially given their sports success when you and I were in. But all tended to be really stellar performers, stellar individuals, the kind of guys who would give their left arm for the buddy next to them in life, not just on the battlefield, in life as well. Is there something there or not?
Well, of course, I'll say the water's colder in New England than anywhere else. And so, you know, you grow up, maybe that Puritan work ethic is a little more centered in a sense of Catholic guilt and you know, exceptionalism. Exceptionalism is throughout the nation and the globe. So certainly, while I can joke about it, look, there's no corner market that any geography has on another. What I will say is that I do agree with what you're saying. It's very funny. There two quick other SEALs from New England who I think the world of. One of them, as you know, Nate Hardy. I got a really good quick story about Nate. We both loved him like a brother. And so one morning at the team, we roll in at whatever we used to get to work at 6 or 6:15 and have our workout at starting at 6:45 or 7 when we were starting late, you know, just rubbing the sleep out of our eyes. Nate looks at my t-shirt and says, "Lake Sunapee," and excuse my French here, but he says, "Sir, what the fuck do you know about Lake Sunapee?" This is a little lake in center of New Hampshire. And I said, "I don't know, Nate. I've only been going there since 0 years old. My great grandfather bought a place there and he said, "Well, that's where I'm from." And so while we were almost a decade apart in age, it felt like there was not a minute between us, and we always had great fun together, and of course Nate killed in action the same day as Mike Koch. And so, you know, you do get a brand, a flavor of SEALs like Nate Hardy. Phenomenal. The second one I did mention in the book, and this is funny, I just reached over and knocked something over. So if you heard the background noise, that was, I was reaching for what came in the mail yesterday. I don't know if we'll see this, but this is the SEAL magazine. This is the Blast. Mm-hmm. And this is my swim buddy from SEAL training on the cover, Chris Cassidy. And he's now an astronaut, and this is our I don't know, monthly or bi-monthly article thing that shows how he was just up in the space station for a second time in his life. And, you know, he and I are as close as they come. And I remember one day in SEAL training, which again, I wrote about in the book, where we you know, every class knows that you're in the cold water for an undetermined amount of time, and you have no idea how long you'll be there. And I remember Chris one day just start belly laughing and saying, "This is hilarious," you know, and all of a sudden, literally we had like, after like about 10 guys quit that day, no, seriously, it was probably 3 or 4, the SEAL exaggeration was coming in there, but you know, but Chris just got the whole class laughing, and we were just like us two New Englanders were like, this is cold, but man, it's like, it's miserable and we love it.
That's amazing. I think one of the best things about Buds, you may have even said this in the book, there are a lot of aspects that are actually fun, even though they suck. And I really like your articulation of the, "This sucks, let's stay here" rule. If I got that right, if I wordsmith that right. And you really develop that kind of gallows humor in the midst of it. It's just, it's a surreal experience.
Oh, it sure is. And it's funny, is what I've learned is that you don't even realize how serious it is while you're doing it. It's after you stop and you have a little bit of time to reflect and normalize, when you look in the rearview mirror, to really process what it is. You know, I really wrestled with whether to write a book. It's a, you know, as well as I do, there's even a little bit of a stigma being a SEAL writing a book. Ultimately, to me, the way I netted it out, it took me, you know, I retired in 2013. So it took me, you know, six years to really start saying, okay, I think I'm going to be good with this. And the way that I squared that circle was that I feel like I have something to say to help people. And what I didn't want was the image of being somebody who's profiting from that SEAL past. And that's why I'm donating all of my profits from the book to a 501c3 that pays a charity that pays off mortgages for Gold Star families. And so I'm literally not profiting a penny on the book. And I feel really good about bringing the message of meaning and impact and excellence and to the world. At the same time, recognizing that it's, you know, the lessons have kind of baked over time. And I think it's actually a lot better being in the rearview mirror by 6 or 7 years. And so that what I struggled with was really how open or vulnerable to be. Obviously, you don't give away any state secrets, but, you know, you can't move people without being yourself and being open and sharing the things that you wrestle with. And I tried to make sure there were more things in that book that didn't make me the president of my own fan club, but instead things that really helped me to help others.
I will give you tons of credit, Mike, for being vulnerable about yourself in the book. And that came through with struggles with pull-ups. And for me, I really, really sucked at rope climbs in the beginning. And I remember, right, the instructors are always harassing the officers, as we all know. Some of it is in good humor. A lot of it isn't, because they want good leaders to come out the other end.
I had one instructor one day, though, tell me in a quiet voice that he loathed me. And just the way he said it, just I really took that to heart. And I got a lot better at rope climbs after that. So I can relate.
I didn't get better at pull-ups. So if that's any consolation, I did my 1.5 this morning, you know.
It's all good. It's all good. Earn our trident every day. Can we talk about rule breaking? You gave an illustration in the book about Sean, who was in an operation center at the time, I believe, and went out on an actual operation when he probably would have been better in the op center. And I actually love, as a side note, your articulation almost in math terms of the expected value of the situation. And I think that's something that probably the military doesn't apply enough in situations, and private sector to a degree as well. But what about post-military? When are those instances that you've chosen to break rules? What kind of framework can we use for when to do that?
Yeah, it's a great topic that I really love. Ultimately, we are here to do the greatest good for the greatest number. In the private sector, it's for the shareholders of a firm. At the end of the day, the shareholders are the owner of a public firm. And so the way I think about it in my C-level role at VMware, a $65 billion enterprise value software company, and I think about, first of all, is there any potentially catastrophic risk to the firm? That answer has to be no. So that's where I begin from my framework. So once you've got that whole set of things aside, that's the area where you can potentially consider what's the rules and then breaking the rules. I'm responsible for global operations and transformation as well. And so what's really interesting when you're transforming these, you know, 30,000 or my last firm was 300,000 people, but still pales in comparison to the 1.2 million person Department of Defense. But transforming these large organizations, what it really takes is not conforming and not doing everything the way things have always been done. You'll never make any progress. So the way I start is by thinking about what's the pace at which the organization is capable of changing? And then pushing right up at that edge, if not 1% over that, 2% over that, so that you're getting that maximum trajectory of change. But if you go 10% too far, you're going to break the organization and you're going to lose people. And so the sweet spot is kind of like, it's like a SEAL's backpack, Spoonie. It's, you know, if we take the small backpack, we're going to fill it up. If we take the large backpack, we're going to fill it up. Right. So you give a SEAL, you know, you're just going to carry as much as you can. I mean, maybe not the perfect analogy, because we did learn that fighting light is right. But in reality, you get the metaphor, you know, is like whatever we're capable of, we're going to carry. And I don't want people, I want people to grow, not break. So that's the way I think about those types of situations.
When it comes to hiring rule breakers, how do you think about that? A lot of people romanticize the rule breaking of entrepreneurs, but a lot of companies, especially more mature ones, are reluctant to hire that entrepreneurial sort of character because they probably had bad experiences in the past with them wrecking house a little bit. What do you look for when you're bringing someone on in terms of that rule-breaking attitude? How can you tell if they're a misfit or if they'll be constructive?
Another phenomenal topic. I'm going to take the question even one step back and abstract out just a little bit and start there, which is thinking about building teams. And so, like you referred to the homogeneity of the SEALs to some degree, although while you and I know that it's not a homogenous organization, relative to most private sector large companies, it is homogenous. And so when I'm thinking about hiring, I'm trying to build a diverse team. We talk a lot right now about diversity, equity, and inclusion, rightfully so. Everybody should have an equal chance and an equal opportunity to do great things, to learn, to be respected in the workplace, et cetera. And at the same time, you know, we need to be mindful of these biases. You know, specifically, you know, there was a great book. It's Kahneman and Amos Tversky was one of the first psychologists who started dealing with real biases and human biases. One of those biases, is called the availability bias. We all have a certain set of information that's available to us, and then there's a bunch of information in the world that's not available to us because we just don't know it. Our solution to problems will be almost pulled entirely from that available set, if you will. And so when we hire, we tend to hire people who are like us. And so what, it's no surprise that when somebody sits across the table from us that looks like us, we tend to think that person is smart, is good looking, et cetera, is strong, is really cool and superhuman. So therefore artists hire artists, engineers hire engineers. The artists never hire the engineers and the engineers never hire the artists. And so now let me zoom out really quickly. And when I'm the commander of a special operations task force in Afghanistan, literally making decisions many, many times a day of what operations we go on, when we drop bombs on buildings or people even, and nothing that I'm like super proud of. It was absolutely my job and I would do it again based on what the nation asked of me. And the thing is, how do you never get that decision wrong? The way you never get that decision wrong, for the record, during my almost year in Afghanistan, we dropped over 1,100 bombs and never harmed anybody we shouldn't harm. Now, if we just relied on Mike Hayes to make the decision every time, we wouldn't have been bad at 1,000. We would not have been perfect. We would have had some sort of errors. So how do you get the errors out in that system? It's diversity to your hiring point. And it's having people who think differently. So in that process, I'm an input and I'm the decider. So what's important is that we get other inputs into the system, e.g. people who think differently, people who are not homogenous, and say, hey, I've got a different idea. And then you have to have a culture that fosters that difference and celebrates it, that doesn't scorn it or despise it or say, no, you're not conforming. So the rule breakers are people you have to have in that system, or else not only would I would have ended up harming people who shouldn't have been harmed, but now in the private sector, we'd be making bad suboptimal decisions. And so it's really about building very diverse teams and welcoming the rule breakers. But again, using that framework we just talked about, not letting them break rules, that's going to cause existential risk to the company.
I'm definitely sensing some threads that I relate to from Ray Dalio's book, Principles. Given that you were at Bridgewater, I'd love to know, because you don't talk about this a lot in the book, what you learned from Bridgewater and essentially Ray Dalio's method of taking a bunch of people, mixing them up. They've got different personalities, but a lot of honesty and rules of the road that he and others pioneered at Bridgewater results in great outcomes. What did you learn there that maybe you didn't know before? And how do you relate that to how we operate in the SEAL teams?
Wonderful. So two things are true at once. Number one is I learned a whole heck of a lot that I didn't know before. At the same time, coming in the front door of Bridgewater, I was already any SEAL would be pretty well oriented to the culture. Because when we're going on an operation, we want people to say, hey, sir, I don't think we're thinking about this the right way. There might be a better way to do this. Because in the teams, as you recall, which I do need to take at some point, I have a surprise for you. But when you were in Baghdad and I was in Fallujah, you were expertly leading night after night after night. And what were you doing? You were saying, what's the vision? What are we trying to do? What's the strategy? So where the vision is the where, the strategy is the how. And then how do you find the how that de-risks the solution as best as possible? And so how does that happen? It happens by people bringing different ideas forward, like we just talked about. And that's what Bridgewater is. When you're trading markets, if everybody defers to Ray Dalio of like buy or sell, okay, let's buy, or okay, let's sell, like you're not going to have an organization. And so he recognizes that, and he's built a system that tries to get into that unknown quadrant, and this is like, so a lot of Bridgewater, kind of predated a lot of things like in my career were already Bridgewater. They just call it something else and use different vernacular. So the thing, but to answer your question directly, I think my biggest learning from Bridgewater was to do a better job of separating your data from your logic, from your opinion. Because like if for example, if I'm in a room and Ray said, by the way, this wasn't my job to make investment decisions. I was part of the management team, but just let's say that I was the guy deciding to buy or sell, gold or the, if Ray says, hey, should we buy the euro or sell the euro? If I sit there and I say buy, I'm just giving my opinion, And so that's not interesting or helpful to anybody. What it really forced you to do there was separate the data you're looking at from the logic you're applying to that data, and then where it leads you. And that way that Ray or others in the room, everybody in the room can say, hey, I don't think you're looking at the right data. There's some stuff you might be missing, or I don't think your logic is right. Or they'll say, when you take your logic and apply it to your data, I don't think it actually leads you to A, it leads you to B. And so that was that crispness of logic and tight, like quick hyperlogical approach of thinking was, I got better at that. And I think the other thing that was really true at Bridgewater was, you know, I started telling Ray about like the intellectual Navy SEALs. And so, you know, like as you know, we're the average of the people we hang out with. And so the reason that I like to hang out with you is because you're faster, stronger, and smarter. And then when I'm around you, I have to become faster, stronger, and smarter. You know, and so that's what we do. Remember those Friday morning, you know, killer workouts? Like, the reason we all get stronger is because we're all pushing each other and competing. And that's what happens mentally in Bridgewater. And I really enjoyed being around people that were, you know, were so good. It's a really strong firm.
There's no pressure like peer pressure, right? I will say I do love the explicit extraction of logic from that opinion data spectrum. I found often in the private sector, especially in, I think, tech companies specifically, there's a little bit of a data fetish, and then there's the isolation of the opinion from the data, but there's not the focus on logic and people walking through arguments from data to get to a conclusion and talking about how it gets drawn out. And I really loved that part of Ray Dalio's book, Principles. And I think firms, organizations could benefit a lot from that. Do you think the candor aspect can go too far? Or maybe when can it go too far? We were pretty brutal in the teams at times, or all the time in debriefs. But I will say I've actually been places post-teams that are more brutal. And one place in specific, in particular, the founders really embraced the Bridgewater way of doing things without ever having been there. I've never worked there. They had not been there, but really embraced what they perceived it to be. And I think there's a possibility that founders with their strong personalities can use that candor principle as a justification for their natural proclivities.
Interesting question, and there's a lot to it. So the thing that I would say is that you need to step back and think about how somebody's delivering feedback. But before you get to the how, you have to add, like, there's a self part, which is, do you want to hear it or not? Like, do you subscribe to the fact that when we were kids, all of our parents paid for coaches to either tell us we were bad at, you know, not good enough at sports or not good enough at an instrument. But now that we're professional and adults, nobody wants to hear it, right? It's like, but you pause and pull back and say, well, why? I remember I was, one of my classmates from the Kennedy School is a professor at HBS now, had me in his classroom. And there's a case on Bridgewater. And I'll recall this guy in the back row asked me about a 3-minute windup of a question. We've all heard the type, you know, try to show everybody how smart you are through the question. And embedded in the question was a very similar thing to what you're asking right now. And I recall saying, you know, before I answer your question, let me just tell you that I really don't think you're a good question asker. Like, that was just a very bad question. It was a 3-minute windup. It seemed like you were trying to impress the entire audience here more than ask your question. And I went on with 2 or 3 other points about the question that didn't make it a good question. And it's a very non-HBS type of approach. And I can get away with that because I'm the guest in the classroom, not the professor. But I said, so look, right now, what I want you to do is think like I haven't said this in a mean way at all. I'm just genuinely very matter-of-factly, very, like, you know, very kindly, frankly, just telling you what I'm observing. Now, do you either want to hear that or not? And if you want to hear it, great. That's how you get better, because what I'm saying is either true or false. Like, my feedback is either true or false. I'm not, you know, you might, but do you want to hear my feedback and then consider it and have the opportunity to potentially get better, or to potentially say, hey, I don't agree with the feedback, or would you rather not hear it? Now, intellectually, we will all give the answer that we want to hear it. But when you're actually in the moment of hearing it, it's harder. And so the reason I'm doing this right now is because this, what I'm doing, is Bridgewater. And so if I'm thinking something, I'm not doing you any favors if I'm not sharing with you what I'm thinking about your question. Now, I hope what you also hear, and this is the answer to your question, is feedback when delivered, it's very easy. The recipient has an easy time telling if you're trying to build someone up through the feedback and help them grow, or if you're trying to tear them down. So the answer to your question centers on the method of delivery of the person giving the feedback. I can tell you, I've given a lot of feedback in my life, and I very, very rarely am I angry. Am I doing it out of spite or to tear someone down? It's just genuinely to build someone up. And so I think that's what differentiates, Sri, how you use the word brutal. Well, it's only brutal if you're tearing somebody down. And that's what I didn't experience that much at Bridgewater. That's not the way it is.
Hey, gang. Hope you're enjoying this episode of The Warrior Poet. If you are, don't forget to subscribe so I can get you more thoughts on leadership, interviews with military experts and business phenoms, as well as other hacks to up your game in your daily life. And please leave a review. Let me know what I'm doing well, which interviews you'd like, and if you like the philosophical musings, footnotes, or critiques of throwback music. Back to the show.
Right. And I should clarify for those who don't know, but in the teams, it's not, you don't experience it brutally. Usually it's just very, very vocal, very pointed, sometimes very loud. And you have to have that sense of humility as well. So I'm curious, there's a part of the book where you talk about something that pretty much anyone who's been a senior enlisted or officer in the teams or in combat eventually learns is to let go of operations that are happening amongst your people, especially when you're in an operations center. The quote is, "When there was no decision I needed to make, merely knowing the information would simply have served to satisfy my curiosity, and that wasn't a high enough bar." In that situation you were in, I believe, you were in an operations center separated by time and space. Granted, you might have video, you have communications, you might have other things telling you what's going on. But in a way, it's a little easier, perhaps, to let go when you are in that situation than it is in the private sector, where you've got everyone at your fingertips. You can get anyone on a Zoom at any time. You've got Tableau or Looker or whatever you're using for your data. How do you let go? And I think this is particularly hard for people who haven't been in the military, who are earlier in their leadership journey and maybe aren't as confident at letting go. What are your tips for them?
Well, I think what's important to start is actually from the leadership principle is thinking you have to design a system where individuals can fail, but the organization can't. Right. And so think about the outcome of someone failing. And so and then with that, how do you as an individual in a situation earlier in your leadership journey, think about leaning into a situation where it's okay to fail? Then the people running the firm, how do they set up a culture where it's like encouraged to try hard things and say, look, it's okay. I think one of the biggest places people get tripped up is that they don't take on hard enough things because they don't go that last tactical yard or mile or whatever the expression is to think to themselves of what will happen if I fail. Now, if you really go that last, tactical yard, you think to yourself, well, really, at the end of the day, it's mostly about ego and pride. Like, I don't want to fail because I don't want to look bad. Like, most of the time when you fail, you're not going to lose your job. You're not going to. And if people who are around you are going to think less of you, they're not the right people to be around. The people who care about you are not going to think less about you because you tried something and failed. So like, I look at, we have success and failure in the logic tree. But it's only failure. You have to go down one more node and say learn and not learn. So it's only failure if you fail and didn't learn. Failure and learning equals success because that's the fastest trajectory to becoming better. And that's really what that first third of the book is all about, is the excellence both individually and organizationally, because the more you're leaning into hard things and building your toolkit, if you will, your set of experiences from which you can draw, then what you have is a better ability to give and to have a larger and wider impact through life. So I think that my main advice would be, don't be afraid to try hard things and hopefully you'll succeed. But if you fail, just make sure you learned, do the introspection and the reflection afterwards to say, what would you do differently?
Makes sense. you talk about having incredible confidence and extreme humility in the book. And I think that relates to the point you were just making about ego and being afraid to fail. I'm curious, in your journey after the team's accomplished career, you're probably really confident in government and military at that point. Can you talk about that journey and in particular, where you failed to have confidence in yourself and how you recovered from that?
Yeah, the honest answer is I don't think I ever didn't have confidence in myself. I think what it was do I want to pay the price was the question. You know, so I went from a situation of being a commanding officer of a SEAL team, like running everything in southeastern Afghanistan, jets and helicopters and unmanned aerial vehicles and every ground vehicle and yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, you know, like and then I went to Bridgewater. You know, I had options at Goldman Sachs, at JP Morgan, at Bridgewater, and I ultimately picked Bridgewater. And look, I had zero direct reports. I was like, hey, here's this thing we need you to go do in your first 6 months. I just drew on that good old fashioned, like, you know, Bud's early SEAL day work ethic and put the pride aside. And, you know, I had 22-year-old kids out of, you know, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Dartmouth, you know, saying, hey, I think there's a better way to do that. And da da da. And nobody cares that you just ran a whole SEAL team, you know. And so the debriefs that you and I grew up in, they prepare you for that. And so to the non-SEAL listeners, what I would say is you need to think about like when in your life, like what's the metaphor for the debrief that we're talking about? You know, if anybody who's a parent has had their kid tell them that they're not a good parent. Like every kid says it at one point, right? You know, and usually we brush it off, but sometimes you step back and say, am I being a good enough dad? Am I being a good enough uncle or whatever the case may be? And so whatever your experience in life is, we've all had these things happen. So how do you act when you're in those situations? It's that calm breeds calm, excitement breeds excitement. And so if you can stay calm in a situation, you're going to maximize that ability to perform. And ultimately, you know, that performance begets more responsibility, begets more performance, and then more, you know, to the point where you do grow. And so every year of my life since I've been out, for sure, and while I was a SEAL, of course, too, but every year I look back, I'll say, well, man, I thought I knew what I was doing last year. I'm actually so much better this year than I was a year ago. Like I've literally felt that every year of my life since I've been out. And that's because I've been trying hard things and trying to make a positive impact for increasingly larger situations and opportunities to create value in the world.
When it comes to that emotion that people can feel when they're in these stressful situations, sometimes emotions can be fuel. Sometimes they can be destructive. You talk in the book about compartmentalization. How do you know when to compartmentalize? Because sometimes it can be good, but sometimes it's a destructive force.
Yeah, dude, that's a great topic. I'm not sure I have the answer. I'll give the best answer I have. First you have to be able to say the word. So it starts with the compartmentalization starts with saying, are there other things that are going on that are going to either distract me or add be accretive to me solving the situation at hand? Look, you and I have both been shot at, right? When you're getting shot at, which is really just a metaphor for anybody in a hard business situation, you know, you need to either, are you going to buy that other product? Are you going to, you know, raise your prices? Are you going to, you know, pay your employees more? Whatever these hard situations are, they're all analogous. They're just decisions. But when you're getting shot at, if we start thinking about all the things that can go wrong, those are not CPU cycles that are going to be helpful to solve and get out of the situation, not only alive, but take care of the situation and achieve the mission. So we know that, right? And so you compartmentalize when you really, I think the framework is the other stuff going on going to add or detract? And now emotion, like you're saying, it can be very difficult to pin down. But one thing I think about is like everybody's seen the football team come on the field where everybody's slapping each other's helmets and like all gird up and, you know, and like they have that big emotion. How many times when you went on a SEAL mission to arguably, not arguably, but higher cost than any football game where we're slapping each other's helmets and like girring it up? Never, right? Not once. because that is like, to me, that is, we don't need that. Like, we are so focused on the mission at hand, rehearsing what are the helicopter landing zones? What am I going to do if this goes wrong? What am I going to do if that goes wrong? Are the comms working? You know, thinking of everything you can possibly think of. So because you're thinking of all these multidimensional things that are going on with that operation, like hitting somebody else in the head is just a distraction, you know? And so that's my best answer for you.
Yeah, going out the door in 30 minutes or less in the middle of the night, it's actually extremely quiet. As you might expect at night, people just get into vehicles, know what they need to do, and going out and executing. Talking about that football players knocking their heads together, it strikes me that maybe that raw energy can be fueled because it's not as multidimensional a space. And they've got a coach. Maybe if they're younger, they've got the players who've been playing a lot longer and they don't need to think quite as much. I don't want to make football to be just a dumb man's game. It's clearly not.
No. I'm not judging football. I mean, that might be right for them.
Right. Totally with you. And I'm also not making football out to be a dumb man's game. Clearly, they talk about football IQ for a reason at those higher levels. I think the point I'm trying to make is that often in organizations, people don't think enough for themselves. And you give a great example in the book of having to give a battle damage assessment in a situation where the risk was not worth that meager reward. And you highlight an argument or conversation, however you want to paint it, with the colonel who was commanding over your unit at the time. What do you think you can do in an organization to get people to not just follow policies? We talked about rule breaking earlier, but how do you even evolve a whole organization to think like you and I do, where the rules are flexible?
Yeah, I think what's important is to recognize the cost of rule breaking. To the earlier thing, maybe what I left out was like that we talked a little bit about, is there existential risk? Like, look, when I have, you know, the general stat and the colonel, like the colonel on behalf of the general calling me and saying, no, this is policy, you have to do it. Look, I'm paid to take risk decisions for the organization. That's what I'm paid to do in my job as the commanding officer of a SEAL team. If I say yes to everybody, I've just prioritized everything and therefore prioritized nothing. And so I understand that, like, that was a very risky decision, because that general literally could say, thanks for playing. Like, you're not following orders. You're going home. And so you have to be very thoughtful and strategic about when you do that. You can't do that kind of thing every day. I knew in my heart and in my head that situation was absolutely right to not follow the order. And look, I wish I wasn't able to prove myself right, but unfortunately, there were a bunch of Afghans that lost their lives because we said no, and so that general got the Afghans to go in and do that thing. And you know, it was actually like, and this is terrible. Like, it's like roughly four guys died. You know, the two vehicles were completely blown up, and it might have been five guys that died. You know, but eight Afghan soldiers that were trying to create peace for their own families and country aren't here today because somebody followed some stupid policy. And I'll tell you, Spoonie, I've got a lot of like emotional days in the teams, but one of the days when the next day after that, when I flew over to the, it was a bunch of wonderful Green Berets who are great Americans, and I flew to their team house. And when I walked in, just the 16 or so, maybe it was 12, I don't know, ODA guys were there. I just sat down in a chair. We were all kind of just, you know, drinking our 120 degree plastic bottles of water. And they said, the senior guy said, first of all, sir, I'd like to start out and tell you, thank you. There are four or six of us who wouldn't be here if you didn't stand up to the general and make that decision. And we don't know very many senior leaders who would have said no. And so we just want to thank you, because some of us are here because of you. We don't even know who it is, but thank you. And I'll tell you, like, they wouldn't have known it, but inside I was overcome with emotion. Like, my throat closed off, my eyes were welling up, you know, and I was just like, man alive, the gravity of the decisions you make are really stark and strong. And look, you've made those, every SEAL of our era have made decisions like that. I'm not patting myself on the back and saying I'm any more special than anybody else. I'm not. But those decisions that you make have to be few and far between. And when they are, you have to be ready to pay the cost.
That's a great segue into talking about meaning and choosing and life and what matters to us outside of work. You dedicate a very substantial part of the book to that, even in the sections where it's not headed by that sort of title. That's a common theme throughout what, again, is an amazing book, and everyone should read it who has any interest in leadership. When we talk about meaning versus material aims, one guiding light you provide us is seeking discomfort. And that's a theme in some of our other Team Guy Brothers books. It's a theme in The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday. And I think a lot of people can learn from that. When someone thinks about your quote, do you stay in a frustrating job that may get you to your goal, or do you leave for a more satisfying position that may not have as much upside, ... which path makes me more uncomfortable? Uncomfortable how? What is positive discomfort, right? I was telling a friend the other day, we could just choose to try and be senior Ironman success. we could try and join the CrossFit Games. That's probably not the best use of our time right now. Granted, I think we're too old to succeed at that, but it can't just be discomfort rampant. It also just can't be everything I'm only passionate about. How do you reconcile that stuff? We've got to put food on the table. We need to find meaning. Sometimes we discover that meaning. That's a big point in Cal Newport's book about career capital. But we also should do the uncomfortable thing. How do we sort this out?
Well, you're asking awesome questions. This is so fun. The way I think about the discomfort point is, first and foremost, is it discomfort that will lead to growth? Discomfort for discomfort's sake is useless. And it's really, frankly, one of the things I wrestled with the title of the book. You know, I've always said excellent people are only excellent if they know that they're never excellent enough. That's where the genesis of that, to the title of my book, comes from. Now, what's important is a lot of people can read Never Enough and get start thinking it's about fame or fortune or, you know, just self-aggrandizing traits. It quite the contrary. And that's what the subtitle is, a Navy SEAL commander on living a life of excellence, agility, and meaning. It's really about meaning and impact. And so the growth, that the discomfort has to lead to more excellence, more agility, more meaning in life. And now back to the earlier point about hiring people who are not like us, how do we also respect the fact that a lot of people have a lot of different interests and a lot of different abilities? When people thank you for your service, I don't know what you say, but what I say is, well, thank you for yours. Everybody serves in different ways. Some people who have run hedge funds their whole life, they just paid a lot more taxes and they buy more SEALs, you know? Great. I thank you for increasing the efficient use of capital. And so doctors, lawyers, teachers, and healthcare workers in the last year and a half right now, like, my goodness, they're heroes, you know? So how do we celebrate the fact that not everybody's service looks the same? And that's what I really want to come out of this book, is for people to recognize that while somebody might not be a SEAL or work in the White House or be in the C-suite of a large public company, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. What matters is, are you finding the ways that you can contribute and create more value in the world, which starts with families, friends, your hometown, the person in the Trader Joe's parking lot who you've never met. And then it gets out to your state, your country, and the globe. And that's what ultimately it's about. So I think I'm not really directly answering your question about how to think about discomfort, but I'm more answering the why behind it. And if you subscribe to the why, then the fact that you accept the discomfort gives you clarity of why you're doing it. Then it becomes a lot easier to get up and go to the gym every morning. Everybody loves ice cream, but you got to eat your broccoli. So how much broccoli are you eating? You know, it's like about lean in and eat that broccoli.
Right. Like our Buzz instructors used to say, it's easy to be a frogman on a sunny day. It's a lot harder when you're in the surf in a winter hell week class. When it comes to family and the trade-offs we have there, or you give so many great insights, advice to readers in terms of never getting complacent in relationships with friends and family, being intrusive in people's lives. And a big part of it is family, especially those of us who have kids, it kind of, as a parent, always feels like you're half-assing it, right?
That's a great question that I don't know if I have the answer to that, honestly. Like, I don't know if I have it right, because I'm the kid, you know, we've all heard of the marshmallow test. You know, you put one marshmallow in front of the 5-year-old and say, look, if you can sit there for 2 hours, you're going to get a second marshmallow. But it's only something like 45% of the kids can get that second marshmallow, you know? And so I was the kid who could get the second marshmallow. So I worry that I've always been kind of saving for a rainy day and keep focusing on trying to build that foundation so that we can give back. But look, I think for me, it is such a personal question. I wouldn't purport to be able to answer it for everybody else. All I can do is maybe unpack that logic we talked about. And I think backwards from like, what do you need? Like, what do you want in life? And what are the true needs? You know, it's Maslow's hierarchy, but how much of Maslow's hierarchy do you need? Do you need top ramen or do you need sushi every day? You know, like points in between, like we're all different. Do you need to live in the 9,000 square foot home, or can you live in the trailer? You know, like they're all okay in different decisions for different people. And so, so that you smartly said, we don't all have the same needs. And so it starts by answering that needs question and working backward from that. And the thing I will say also, though, is it really is nice. I've worked really hard over the last 8 or so years and fortunately been in a position now where I'll tell you, like, my mother-in-law is going into a home right now. It costs a lot of money a month. There's no insurance that pays for it. There's no nothing. It's like literally dollars out of pocket. I'm really thankful that, you know, this is like an extra $7,000 a month. I'm just really thankful that I'm able to just do that. And now she's got a great setup and she's transitioning into this home. And so, like, we have needs that we can't predict, is my point. Like, if you would have said to me 10 years ago, hey, do you need $7,000 a month to put your mother-in-law into a home? I wouldn't have been thinking like that, you know? And so the point is, you know, we're all at a point in our life where we can't see around the corner. So how do we do the best we can for the unforeseen corner? That's all about preparation. I just don't have a good answer, because sometimes I worry that, you know, like I could be working half as hard as I do and in much, you know, much more relaxed lifestyle, I'm sure. But also, I'll tell you, part of the reason I keep working hard is because I feel this weight on me. Look, I love giving back. I also feel a little bit of a burden because I have been, to those who much has been given, much is expected. You and I have had a lot of experiences that the world hasn't had. How do we bring those experiences to the world? It's ultimately why I wrote that book, sitting over my shoulder, I just realized. And so that's really the obligation. You know, I'll tell you, donating the money to charity from the book. I've paid off 5 houses for fallen SEAL families, for Gold Star families. And like, these are life-changing and game-changing situations for these families. And I really love to be able to do that. It's very quiet. I have no website, no fanfare. If you know how to dig into the IRS's website and find one small, you know, subpage of a subpage, you'll see that it's legit. And that's the only place. And you'll find out it's incorporated at my home address. We have no full-time employees, no nothing. We don't ask for pictures after we write the check. We just, like, help in very quiet ways. And it's and for me, when you say how much is enough, it's never enough, because we're here to give back.
I would strongly encourage folks who, again, have not read the book to support this cause, or even if you don't feel like reading, even if you'd rather listen to a podcast like The Warrior Poet and get all your information there, that's fine. But please support the kinds of charities and nonprofits that Mike is talking about here. It's for a very good cause, and those families have given literally everything to help us all be free. As we wrap up here, Mike, I will say there were several moments in the meaning sections that caused me to tear up. Your relation of the 270 note cards, our kids are about the same age, you know, our families know each other, and I know the, you know, your classmate who took his own life, and the story about our teammate and brother Kyle as well. What advice would you give people to invest in their relationships now, today?
Yeah, man, it's tough. I would just say quality over quantity. You know, like just think of every day as quality and do everything we can to have quality in our relationships. And really, it starts there. We tend to take for granted the fact that we're in the house at the same time. Life gets very busy and complicated and fast and we're working. The advice would be slow down and make sure there's quality. And the other thing is being intrusive in people's lives and really understanding what they're dealing with and what they're going through. I used to think of intrusive as a bad word. It's not. You can't help if you're not intrusive. And asking the number of times I've asked people, have you ever considered harm to self? That's being intrusive. You know, like that's an extreme example. But like, and you know, out of every 100 times I ask that question, 95 times it's incredibly awkward. 5 times the answer is yes. If it was 1 time out of 1,000, I'd rather be embarrassed 999 times and get the one yes and then help out, you know? And so I think that's a real thing. I know we're winding down on time. I have this thing in front of me that I really want to read because I want your audience to know about you. I will say, look, I was the second in charge of the SEAL team when Andrew and I were overseas together. And look, everybody in the SEAL team is so wonderful in so many different ways, but there was no leader better than who I affectionately and lovingly call Spoonie, and Sri and Andrew and all of the above. This guy for the audience like went out night after night in incredibly dangerous situations, exhibited incredible calm, professional leadership in the hardest of situations you can possibly imagine. And it's an incredible sacrifice that I wasn't going out every night. I went out every 4th or 5th night. You had it infinitely harder than I did. And I always look up to you. And I just want to be on the record saying that. I really mean that because you were leading the guys night after night at the very front end. And then I was very fortunate when as Andrew was getting out, he asked me to write him a letter of recommendation for Harvard Business School. And I had already been to the Kennedy School. I just want to read a quick little section here. These were words that I really meant, but I want your audience to hear this. I'm not going to do the whole letter, but as a Navy SEAL officer and Andrew's boss, I am qualified to state that there is no finer SEAL or naval officer than Andrew Sridhar. I'll pause there and just tell you, those weren't words that I just wrote. Those are real words. I said, I know you've had several SEALs in your program over the past years that you as a selection board are certainly familiar with. The characteristics inherent to a SEAL like Andrew, an intense results-oriented drive that does not rest until successful completion of the task at hand, an unmatched ability to forge a group of people into one team that moves forward together, an unusual ability to remain calm under periods of intense pressure, and an ingrained integrity that makes the right decision regardless of personal difficulty or discomfort. Andrew exhibits these traits like no other. But then there are approximately 4 SEAL officers per year who serve as a ground force commanders and are placed in charge of our operations in and around Baghdad. Andrew is one of these 4. There is no one in your applicant pool who has done what Andrew has done. The stakes he faced couldn't be higher. He is placed solely in charge of the most sensitive and dangerous missions and makes the final decision relating to all actions taken on the ground. He is responsible for men's lives as well as making tactical decisions on the ground that have national strategic level importance. There is simply no SEAL officer more capable or qualified than Andrew Sridhar. That's just part of the letter, but I just want your audience to hear that because those aren't just words on a letter. Those are really heartfelt, my friend.
Mike, I'm a little verklempt here, not because of those kind and flattering words, but which I do appreciate. But because it was such an honor to lead and work with just the finest people in the world, including yourself, all the men who came out with me every night, questioned my decisions, told me when I was fucking up and things I could do better, adding their ideas, their grit, giving their lives in some cases, like giving other parts of their abilities every single night we went out. It was the highlight of my life, the ability to serve there with all of them. So it really goes to the entire team, but I really appreciate that. And just want to say, I learned so much from you and the teams. I learned so much from you through your book and through this interview. And it's always a pleasure, but I'm incredibly grateful for you joining me today.
Well, no, the pleasure and the honor is mine. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for who you are and all you've done. And I appreciate also for everybody listening. please, like Spoonie Shree has said, please do go buy the book. It's $20 on Amazon or Barnes and Noble or wherever you get books. It's more than a book. It's a mission. I think you'll like the content, but even if you never read and you pass it on to someone else, like all of the profits are going to the Gold Star families. Greatly appreciate the support. And it's available on audiobook or Kindle on Amazon. I did the reading of the whole book for audiobook. And then I just shamelessly ask the audience to please help bring this message of meaning and impact to the world. And I greatly, greatly thank you.
Mike, keep doing great things. Thanks so much. And let's chat again soon.
No, Kevin. Mina dua. Spita.